is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us today. Historians say that African food traditions date back thousands of years, rooted in indigenous agriculture practices, trade, migration, and many other factors. It's perhaps why traditional African cuisine is as varied as the continent itself, encompassing a wealth of ingredients like grains, vegetables, spices, and proteins. In the new cookbook, The Contemporary African Kitchen, award-winning chef Alexander Smalls highlights Africa's culinary diversity with 120 dishes from chefs that are at the forefront of the continent's food movement. He says that the book tells the stories of chefs who are reinventing African cuisine for a global audience while offering a window into Africa's culinary future. He joins me together with the book's co-author and founder of Dine Diaspora, Nina Oduro. I started off by asking how the collaboration came together.
The book really has been my journey through the lens of food. I grew up in Gullah Geechee community, Gullah Geechee culinary experience. The one thing you can say about Gullah Geechee folk is that you know who they are by what they eat. And the Gullah Geechee is Charleston, Beaufort, and the Gullah Islands, a direct connection to West Africa.
Yes.
Absolutely. And of course, enslaved Africans were not allowed to read or write. So they kept the stories and the lore of who they were and where they came from through oral history. So much of my young life was spent with oral history about West Africa, the Gullah Geechee people, and the ancestors. So fast forward, after an operatic career and traveling throughout the world, one of the things I noticed is that we as Black people were not in the culinary conversations, etc. I mean, our food was just not considered worthy to be embraced.
Just be spoken of.
Absolutely. And so when I decided that I was no longer going to pursue a career in classical music, I decided I was going to open the first fine dining African-American restaurant. And so I did. In the early 90s, I brought the food of the Gullah Geechee people to New York, and I created a culinary expression that was fine dining with wine pairing and all this stuff, and people thought I had lost my mind. I say to young chefs all the time, the reason I was able to do that is because I owned. And so through all the naysayers, and all of which were not other than African-Americans, because African-American people thought I'd lost my mind. But I set out to do this thing, which was a tremendous success, but it laid the foundation, because after three restaurants based on Gullah Geechee culture, I started to think about where did this start?
Where did it come from?
The connection. Yeah. And then I took 10 years off, traveled the transatlantic slave trade, the Far East Indian Ocean slave trade into India, China, and Asia. And I understood that the footprint of African people were basically on five continents. And so I created a culinary discipline that was built on, through slavery,
tracing those different
areas. Absolutely. How through slavery, Africa changed the global culinary conversation. This led to opening the first Afro-Asian American brasserie in New York, which the recipes were put in a book, Between Harlem and Heaven, which won the James Beard Award and set me out on a bigger journey. The call came to open the first African dining hall in the world in Dubai. And Nina followed me there, documented the experience with her film crew. And essentially, that dining hall became the blueprint for this book. Now, the step I'm leaving out is essentially once I had brought on Faden, they loved the idea of Faden Press.
Faden, makes, the publishers
yes,
of the book, yeah.
Makes some of the most beautiful books in the world. Once they signed on and agreed, and this at this point was my third book, it was like, okay, go do it. And I realized I was missing something. And what I was missing was Nino Duro.
Yes.
What I was missing was a project manager and a co-curator who could help me put all of this on paper.
Yeah.
So what we did is we created a tribe. We essentially decided that we were doing this book, North, South, East, West, and Central Africa. And we, through our chef community, because we're very visible on social media, we had built already a community of chefs globally of the African diaspora. So we got busy. My reputation in the field attracted a lot of people. Nina's reputation for working with chefs in the D.C. area. And we put together our tribe.
I love it. I love it. You call it the tribe. So, Nino, he says that the faster, I guess, the idea to bring you onto the project started when you went to document the restaurants, his restaurant in Dubai. How did you find out about Alexander in the first place?
And really, really funny and interesting story. So social media does a lot for everyone. So our story goes back to social media. So while running Dine Diaspora, we heard about all the amazing work that Alexander had been doing in New York and throughout the African diaspora foodways in general. And my business partner, Mami Boachi, and I said to ourselves, we have to meet this guy. He's so incredible. We DM'd him. We sent him a direct message, and he responded. Wow. We said, we love you. We want to come to New York. We want to meet with you. Alexander actually responded and said, come, and let's go out to lunch. We had lunch. We brought our book with us for him to sign, thinking that, you know, at least we got his signature.
One of his books.
Yes. At least we got his signature, if nothing else. But even that day, Alexander began to turn his mind around how we could work together in the future. And so oftentimes when we would meet again, we developed a friendship, and he kept saying, we're going to work together. And the call came years later for this book.
Yeah, tell them where you were.
I was actually in Bangladesh. Working on another project at that time. Hours in between us, maybe 14, 50, I don't even remember. It was very much a long period of time between us. But he called, and I was like, I'm here. He's like, what are you doing there? I was like, whatever. He's like, whatever you're doing.
Stop.
Yeah.
We need to get on next flight.
We have a book to do. So.
I love to hear that. So let's talk about the book itself. How does this cookbook aim to make African cuisine more accessible to global audiences?
Oh, my goodness. There's never been a book like this. And, you know, we understood very early in the process, and again, this is a little piece I left out with respect to process. When I opened the African Dining Hall in Dubai, I had written every recipe and concept. I had done everything. And then I paused because I thought how arrogant an African-American designing and developing this whole conversation about Africans. Mm-hmm. And while I consider myself an African, I'm a few generations removed. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, I said, I have to regroup. I have to invite Africans to be a part of this for the authenticity and the trust and the shared value. Because, you know, the whole idea is to build bridges and to get us all at the table. Mm. And so that's when I brought in other chefs and gave them the opportunity to create their own sense of expression. So that same concept came alive in this book. We put together 32 chefs, or is it 33?
33.
So
many.
In different time
representing
zones,
different
languages.
Parts of the continent.
Represent, yes, because once we understood how we were going to populate the book, North, South, East, West, Central, then we understood what we needed to do. There was no way to bring all 54 countries of Africa. The book would be this big.
Yeah.
But what we could do is bring chefs who are a part of the various regions that we wanted to share. The idea was, and we gave them specific criteria, you know, we wanted it to show their best. Nina asked them, if you were making a dinner for Alexander, what would you make? This is what we want you to bring to light.
Yes.
And so they took the instructions and ran with it. But the other criteria was, because these are leading chefs, they had to create these recipes for the home chef. I wanted women in Iowa, you know, in Nebraska, Arizona, in the South. I wanted people to pick this book up, first and foremost, relate to each chef personally, because the way we
create that
curated it, they tell their story. They're up close and personal. They tell you about where they came from, who they are, and then they made the dishes so simple yet so incredibly elegant and rich that anyone could pick up this book and make that. So the idea of the book was not only to educate, but to give people, to demystify African food and give people an opportunity to embrace it as a cuisine they could own.
So Nina, speaking about demystification, I want to ask you, first of all, how did you select these chefs? What was the criteria? But going back to the little to some of the demystification, what would you say are some of the misconceptions about African food that you hope this book will help address?
Yeah, so Alexander shared a bit about how we selected, right, making sure that they were for the home cook. But one thing that he didn't share is that these chefs had to already be present in Africa doing incredible work already in the culinary scene. So, you know, these chefs had to have concepts of their own. You know, they're not just, you know, in and out of Africa, you know, and elsewhere, but they're actually entrenched in the communities that they're from, doing some kind of culinary work. So that was a big criteria for this book that I would add to Alexander's. And then you asked about demystifying, repeat that
question. Some of the misconceptions that will be demystified by this book.
I think there's some that will be demystified, certainly, but there's some that I think people just have gaps in knowledge. And this book will do more of that because what we believe is that the people featured in this book are already demystifying. Every day they're sharing their recipes. Every day they're sharing a lot of the works that they're passionate about through food. So they're already doing this work. What this book does is fill some of the gaps about recipes that people may not know of, but it doesn't entrench Africa into just a box, right? It shares with you that there's many, many, many foods, many, many dishes across the continent, and there's many people behind that food. And they're doing incredible work to shape how you view it and how you taste
and
it
how you
experience it.
Yeah.
In case you're just joining us, this is Upfront on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. We are chatting with award-winning chef Alexander Smalls, together with Dine Diaspora co-founder Nina Oduro, about the new cookbook, The Contemporary African Kitchen.
So what are some of the regional cooking techniques or ingredients that you feel were underrepresented globally? Because I know many people who have, I don't know if you have some North African chefs in here.
Oh, absolutely.
Most people have said, well, I've never tested a North African food. I don't know how it tests. It's not well represented.
Well, and guess what? The book in and of itself, let's take North Africa. You know, those chefs, Morocco, Egypt, Tunisia, they are bringing, you know, their dishes. Let's take couscous. A lot of people still don't know what couscous is. Mm. And it's an incredible stew of that's served with roasted, grilled, or braised meats. There's a lot of chutneys and spices and sauces that go with it. And you know, it's truly one of my favorites. But also the grain couscous. A lot of people haven't been exposed to it. Most people think it's Italian pasta, you know. And interestingly enough, you know, there's this huge movement, Fonio.
Yeah,
that our dear friend, Chef Pierre Cham, who is also in the book, is bringing back to life. You know, so these kind of grains, you know, as well as rice, which actually, interestingly enough, rice is that that ingredient that built the South. Mm. People think it's cotton, but it was rice.
I'm just learning that right now. Actually, that, you know, yeah.
And these growers were selected from certain parts of West Africa in order to do that work. I say all that simply to say that the ingredients here are not mystifying. Mm-hmm. They're not complicated. Mm-hmm. Most people have, at some point in their life, you know, experienced a couscous salad, maybe, you know, because that grain sometimes gets used in sort of a vegetables kind of salad thing. But to see it in its authenticity, and then to have these chefs take you on a journey of their home dishes, making them as comfortable and as accessible as Italian food.
Yeah. And yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I would also, you know, add to that that there's going to be elements that are new to people. You know, Central Africa hasn't been celebrated for food like other parts of the continent. You may have heard of South African dishes, West African, East African, all over. But Central Africa gets to shine here in this book. The other thing that people get to do is really see that there's different ways of cooking African food. It doesn't have to be traditional. And these chefs show us new ways of re-envisioning some of the ingredients.
Yeah.
And we also offer options and substitutions just in case, for whatever reason, they can't find them.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we don't want to overly demystify because we also want people to rise to the challenge. You know, when you talk about egusi, you know, and what that is, and you know, they're surprised to learn it's a melon, and they're surprised to learn that the seeds contribute so much to the flavor component. Mm. So, you know, we want people to embrace, even if it's a challenge or even if it's like, oh, I never had that before.
How much of that information is contained in the book?
It's there.
The extra information on the...
Yeah, so
it's
each
all in
recipe
here.
Has a story from the chef's perspective. So many times you'll learn about the actual name of the dish in the local language. Many times you'll hear a story or read a story about how that chef maybe interacted with the dish as a child and grew up and then started making it. So there's a lot of background information about each of the recipes.
Now, I know, Nina, you were from Ghana, West Africa. You enjoy a lot of Ghanaian dishes. But can you talk about a traditional Ghanaian dish? Actually, I want to first ask, which Ghanaian chef did you select? I'm sure you had a little difficulty in deciding on which one of the chefs but also talk about any of the traditional dishes in Ghana that was reimagined in an unexpected way in this book.
So let me just say, there's not just one, right? There's multiple Ghanaian chefs in this book, just like there are from other countries. And I wasn't responsible for anyone. It's a collaboration between Alexander and I to make sure that if they were represented here, that they're bringing a lens of a country that needs to be in this book. And then as far as the dish, Nana Araba Wilmot does emutuo. Emutuo is a rice ball with peanut butter stew. She does one that is actually fried in dough. So it's quite Italian spin on it. She has this is one of her signature dishes that she brought to this collection. So many Ghanaians might walk to this and be like, ooh, this is not regular emutuo, but that's just fine.
Yeah.
This is a take on it that really allows us to re-envision something that we already love.
Yeah.
But also, that's the point. You see, the contemporary.
Yeah.
So these chefs are already working with global flavors and tastes all over the globe. And so bringing that back to their traditions is really what we were looking for. We want them to reinterpret, you know, their legacy for the world to enjoy.
Yeah. Is there a particular recipe or story that stands out to you personally for both of you in here?
There's so many stories. And I think one of the ones that sticks with me a lot is our North African chef, Muhammad Kamal, who is provides recipe from the Nubian people. This is a group that doesn't always get to, actually has seldom gotten to provide their dishes to the world. And so having his dishes and dishes from the Nubian people is central and critical for telling the African story.
Award-winning chef Alexander Smalls, together with the co-author Nina Oduro, about their new cookbook, The Contemporary African Kitchen. Let's take a quick break and be right back.
Hello, I'm Vincent McCourty, host of Straight Talk Africa. Join me to explore what is now and what is next for African society, culture, and politics. We'll go behind the headlines and emerging trends shaping Africa today. Straight Talk Africa, every Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
This is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. As the 2024 United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP29, continues this week in Baku, Azerbaijan, rights organization Amnesty International is calling on wealthier nations to make substantial financial commitments to support communities in sub-Saharan Africa that are suffering from the adverse impact of climate change. The organization says that wealthier nations with the greatest responsibility for global warming must commit to covering the devastating losses and damage affecting lives and livelihoods across Africa. Nchiko Wanchiko is Amnesty International researcher on climate change. He says that rich nations have so far pledged less than $700 million of the $400 billion that lower-income nations expect to counter the climate crisis. He joins me from the DRC.
How critical is it that richer nations, wealthier countries, that they step up with financial support at COP29 that is taking place right now in Azerbaijan? And what would meaningful commitments look like?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for that question. And thank you very much for having me. Indeed, displacement has been one of the greatest impacts of climate change events, as we have documented and observed on the continent. As you rightly put it across, like be it droughts, cyclones, floods, these have been leading to millions of people to lose their homes and to embark on displacement as a result of the losses that they're experiencing. However, what has been somehow a bit sad has been the commitment of richer nations in terms of attending to the losses and damages caused by climate change and the consequences of these losses and damages, because once your house, your village is destroyed, you are somehow forced to embark into forced displacement. But now the issue that we've been really, really facing has been a commitment on the part of richer nations. For example, the continent needs billions of dollars to just adapt on the impact of climate change. Yet richer nations have so far committed less than $700 million to fight climate change, the needs that the continent have. So this COP is somehow really, really critical in the fight towards the fight against climate change, particularly the impact of climate change such as displacement, because for the first time, countries around the globe are coming together to agree on what they are calling a new quantified goal on climate finance. So basically, this will have to be based on the needs that we are seeing on the continent.
Right.
Because the financial arrangement that we've been going by was the one of 209. It was not based
on damage.
Yeah, on any need assessment.
Yeah.
But for this particular time, we are going with this new financial arrangement that is currently being discussed in Azerbaijan. And the idea is to really, really make it grounded in the actual needs that we are seeing on the continent.
Right.
And the finance package that African countries are going after is actually in trillions of dollars. It's no longer billions. And this is understandable because climate change impacts have been increasing and worsening on the continent.
Like you said, the Fund for Loss and Damage has received far less funding than African countries need to address the climate crisis. You put the figure towards $700 million, is that correct?
Yeah. $700 million.
That's way below the billions of dollars that have been committed. What kind of impact would adequate funding have on African communities that are facing severe climate-related hardships? What would the money do?
Yeah, so the money would really help affected communities, affected individuals, to address first the losses they are experiencing, be it in terms of their house being destroyed, their farms, their agricultural lands being destroyed, the cattle that they've been losing. It can also help these communities to adapt, of course, with the help of their countries, to the impact of climate change. And this can be, for example, countries such as Madagascar are arguing for putting in place a green belt around a part of the country that is experiencing severe drought, bringing water within that part of the country such that communities that live there can continue doing agriculture, which has been their primary means of survival, of subsistence.
Good. All right. So given the historical responsibility of wealthier countries in driving global warming, we know that Africa, you know, contributes way below in terms of carbon emissions, way below their Western counterparts. What ethical obligation do you think that wealthier nations have to fund adaptation and loss and damage initiatives across Africa?
So the obligation is there, and it is ethical, but it is also a legal obligation because the injustices are really, really there. And we've agreed through the Paris Agreement, for example, that the burden of responsibility, most of it really lies with richer countries, with wealthier countries. So the law is clear. The rhetoric is really, really clear. Richer countries have accepted their responsibility. But the major issue that we've been experiencing in the fight for climate justice is that the rhetoric has not been followed by concrete action, by real action. We have an amazing text in place, but we have not yet implemented them. And even the $700 million that have been committed so far, they have been in form of pledges, but not yet actual commitment. So what has really been missing has been following rhetoric with real action. So right. It really is a question of political goodwill, to go back to the ethical dimension of this problem that you've raised.
Now, one of the things that we've seen, actually a very critical issue here in the last 10 years that we've had these climate change, you know, meetings, so the last 15 years, is that the international community often struggles with fulfilling climate finance promises. But from your perspective, what mechanisms could ensure that funds are actually, when they receive the funds, they are equitably distributed and effectively reach the communities that are in the greatest need?
Yeah, it all comes down to the need of support, because as we are making a case for funds, we are not just asking for these funds, like the fund responding to loss and damages and any other financial arrangements that a state might agree upon during this COP. So we are not just arguing for the establishment of this fund. We are not just arguing for these funds to somehow have concrete money being deposited into them. We are also arguing for accessibility, for these funds to be accessible to the countries that are in need of these finances so that they can respond properly to the impact of climate change. Mm-hmm. And what we have documented so far in countries such as Somalia that are experiencing severe flooding, severe drought because of climate change, the same goes for Madagascar. These countries have not yet received even the little money that has been played so far in terms of responding to climate change. And this is just for a simple reason. It comes down to questions of capacity. The procedures are very cumbersome, and the countries are not in a position to really, really follow through so that they can access these fundings. So the other thing that we are really arguing for as Amnesty International is not just for there to be funds, but these funds are to be accessible. So the quality of the fund is really, really key. Some countries have been receiving funds in terms of debt, such as in terms of loans. And this has been worsening the capabilities of these countries actually to respond to climate change. So the question of debt is also a critical one in the fight against climate change impact on the continent.
That was Nchiko Wanchiko, Amnesty International researcher on climate justice. He joined me from the DRC. And with that, we come to the end of our show today. Many thanks to our guests and to you, our listeners. Remember to connect with us on our social media platforms. We are at VOA Africa. Check out our website at voaafrica.com for more episodes of Upfront and other shows. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead, Africa.